This is Ben Katz. Today is May 4th, 2023, and I am conducting this oral history interview for the Dartmouth Vietnam Project. I am conducting this interview with Mr. Robert Munson. This interview is taking place in person in Carson Hall on the campus of Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. Mr. Munson, thank you for being with me today.
You're welcome.
All right, so let's take it back to the start. Where and when were you born?
I was born in Brooklyn, New York on April 4th, 1947.
All right. Can you describe your family for me, your parents?
My father was career military. He was a pilot in the Navy. Graduated from Cornell. And he was in the Navy from 1937 until 1959. So while I was my young years, my mother was a public school teacher. She graduated from PS1 in New York City, went to school at University of Michigan, got a degree in physical education, and and she met my dad during the course of the war, and had a lot of kids and moved around a lot. So that was my progenitors. I had five brothers and sisters, and moved around a lot as a child. So,
gotcha. What was your experience with moving around a lot as a child? Did that change? Do you think it changed the way you grew up at all?
I think it. Well, first of all, I don't have any lifelong friends. Number one. Mm. Nobody that I knew in first to 12th grade do I have any connections with. However, it did allow me to be chameleon-like in traveling. I love to travel. I've never felt uncomfortable in new places because I know how to adapt into situations where I don't know anybody. I've learned through that people are pretty much the same everywhere we go. They may speak a different language, they may eat different types of food, but the percentage of them that are good, bad, whatever, is pretty much the same wherever one goes.
All right. Can you take me through some of the places that you lived?
Started off born in New York City. My dad moved to Rhode Island when he was I'm number two. We lived in New York. And until my dad moved to Newport, Rhode Island. He was in War College there. We then moved to Dayton, Ohio, where my third brother was born. Then we moved to Newfoundland, or Gentia, Newfoundland. Then we moved to Kansas. And then we moved to Corpus Christi, Texas, and then to Hawaii, and then back to Coronado, California, and then to Bremerton, Washington, and then to Arlington, Virginia, and then to Newport, Rhode Island. We lived in East Greenwich. My dad was stationed in Newport.
So were your times in each of those places about the same amount of time, or were you?
No, it was very limited. They were moved around a lot more frequently when I was very young. Mm. I spent I essentially had one school year in most of the places. With the exception of Hawaii, we were there for 3 years, 1954 to 1957. Right. And then in California and Washington, I split the third grade. We moved halfway through my third grade. And then we moved to Virginia. We were again there for 3 years. And then my dad retired. We moved to Rhode Island. I was in eighth grade then. And I finished up my schooling there and then moving to other places on my own.
So you're in Rhode Island for high school, right?
Yep.
How was your high school experience?
Not very good.
Not very good.
It was too different from what I had grown up with in Virginia. Arlington, Virginia is an amazing school system there, and I flourished there fantastically. East Greenwich, Arlington, Virginia is a hub of lots of things. It's the Pentagon is there, the DC. It's a place, it's a suburb of the district. So you get a lot of people who have traveled, people who are in, military families, government families. So a certain type of people, I think, that were there, very welcoming, there weren't a lot of people that had been there for that long. So you had a kind of transitory, so I fit right in. And then moving to East Greenwich, Rhode Island, Greenwich actually, much more parochial attitude, and I did what I always did. I tried immediately to say, here I am, and wasn't very successful at that. And the dynamic way that the school worked, by the culture of Rhode Island is very insular as opposed to open where I was from. So very quickly I was lost, and I never got involved with much of what was going on there. I kept trying to do new things. So very quickly I decided that the solution was to get out of there and get out of high school as quickly as possible and sanely as possible and go someplace else. So it wasn't a good experience for me personally, shall we say. So
did you have any escapes? Did you have anything that you...
Yeah, actually, my escape was, that's where I learned to bowl.
Bowl?
Yeah. And out on the base where we were, my dad was stationed, Quonset Point, there was a bowling alley, and it was a Saturday morning young adults league. And that's where I actually made friends. I had a couple of girls that we became friendly with. And so that was really my only real escape. I didn't really ever connect with my classmates. You know, played a little bit of sports. I was in like high school play, you know, did a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Did okay academically. It was in the advanced classes and things, but never really linked up. So that was my escape, was to go on Saturday mornings. And then I would date this one girl in particular. She was my point of contact with the opposite sex through high school. But I had nothing, but she had nothing to do with, that was a escape in that we had no common friends. You know, she was lived in North Kingstown. I lived in East Greenwich. We saw each other on Saturday mornings and then on dates. And when I would go to pick her up, we would go someplace else and go back. We didn't go to school functions or anything like that. So that was really the only escape I had, was Sue Steele and bowling.
Did you spend a lot of time on the base, or was it just those Saturday mornings?
That was about it. We would go, my parents would, it was a steamship round Sunday afternoon dinners that we would go out onto the base. The base was in North Kingstown. We lived in East Greenwich, and there really weren't any other activities. We belonged to a country club in East Greenwich, so even though I had an ID card, I could go onto the base. There really wasn't anything there other than the bowling alley to attract me or anything like that.
All right. So what year do you graduate high school?
1965.
1965. So just a couple of years earlier, John F. Kennedy is killed. Is there any kind of reaction? I know you come from a very military family. Was there any effects in your family? Any effects socially in high school?
It was a seminal moment, no question. Mm. I remember I was in English class, and my teacher, Mrs. Roderick, fantastic English teacher. I had some really great teachers in my high school. We were sitting there, and her husband came knocking on the door. So he comes into the class, pulls her aside, and she comes back, and she sits down at the desk and puts her hand over, puts her, you know, head on the desk, and her hands in her face. So we found out then what happened, what they did at the school is they said, everybody home. And then the next day we had an assembly where we all sat around and talked about what was going on. We went home, they sent us all home, and we saw all of the, you know, the thing with the ruby and all that. And I would say it, you know, again, for whatever reason, I'm not somebody who is quick to emotionally engage in those kind of situations. So it was obvious something had happened. But then again, we had just gone through the Cuban Missile Crisis, and we were in the middle of a Cold War with Russia. So there's a lot of foreign policy was a big deal in those days. There was a lot of other things going on. And the beauty of this country is that when something like this happens, there is, you know, no coup is going to happen. There was this, you know, LBJ was sworn in immediately. And the point of government was that at that point in time is everybody has to calm down. We're going to solve, you know, don't go crazy. And so it was a time of mourning and introspection wasn't a time for anybody to take to the streets and start yelling and screaming about some political entity or what that. So, of course, there's been lots of conspiracy theories thrown on around about it, but the government was very quick to try to tamp down on that. And I think it did help. I mean, everybody was, I think it was very similar to if you had a family member who had been killed in a car accident individually. If everybody in the country had a family member that was, that died in a situation too soon. So everybody was sad for the same person, but I didn't rise to the level of you know, panic or chaos or anything like that, I would say.
So you briefly mentioned the Cold War, and obviously Vietnam is all about, you know, we have the capitalist and the communist. Do you remember the first time that you heard about things happening in Vietnam?
I knew pretty much from the get-go. I mean, my family was very politically engaged, and my dad being in the military, even though he got out before things really started, we were a family that paid attention to the news, and current events were part of my schooling as well. And so we did know what was going on. And we just got through with Korea, so our country had been on pseudo-war footing for a long time.
For sure.
Pretty much. And this was just another iteration of that at some level. We know what's going on. Obviously, the government was wanted to be able to do more than what they could present. Mm-hmm. So we needed, as soon as the Gulf of Tonkin happened, you know. But because it was never, our government never really engaged in trying to explain to the public why this needs to happen, and because we just had a stalemate go on in Korea, I think the powers that be were, they really didn't know what to do, and how are we going to do this, and how are we going to do that. And I think that was one of the big problems with the Vietnam War, is that they tried to backdoor a lot of things instead of trying to get the public engaged, which is why we disengaged quickly, because then people weren't engaged in the first place. It was just those of us that went were, well, this is what you do. It wasn't as if there was some second alternative. You know, then only after the lottery came into being did you start seeing a lot of when we go to Canada, bring the draft card, all of that kind of stuff. Didn't happen until a larger percentage of the population became without, we had to become engaged, because they were then really going to be part of it, much more likely to be part of it.
All right. So let's shift quickly back to you personally. So you graduate high school 1965.
Yep.
What's the next move for young?
Well, I just wanted to get out of there, so I applied to a bunch of colleges, got accepted at Georgia Tech, so, oh, okay, I'll go down there. It's been a year down there, and I just went, I mean, I did what freshmen do, and there was no grade inflation back in the day. So at the end of my second semester there, they said, we think it would be a good idea if you take some time off and come back later. And the minute that happened, I was a 1A and I was drafted. It happened within, you know, the letters passed in the mail. Because that was would have been May of 1966. And so immediately I was drafted. And so I had already gone through my pre-induction physical while I was in Atlanta. So I was ready to go. So I was scheduled to appear for induction in September. And in the summer I went home, I worked for 3 months. I knew I was, you know, I'd already got my, there was no second choice. I was going into the military, and talked up with my father and a few other people. And, you know, should I go and should I volunteer for the Navy? Should I do something other than just get drafted into the Army? And the wisdom was that if I took the path of volunteering, then I would have more control over what would happen to me when I went in. So I grabbed at that. And so I raised my right hand and I looked around and I said, oh, engineering, that looks like a good idea. So that was what I went down and I enlisted for 3 years. I took 3 years active instead of two. And away I went.
All right. So After you enlist, where's the first place that you go?
Well, I went to Fort Dix is where I was inducted. Then I went to Fort Jackson, South Carolina for my basic training.
Mm-hmm.
And then Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri for my advanced individual training. And then I was again in kind of a... I did nothing. This is all new to me. I have no idea what's going on. So they say, hell, you know, you could potentially be an officer. You're smart enough. I'm a relatively intelligent human being. So I passed all the tests. So they gave me these math, science, top of the bunch. So they said, well, you should go to OCS and see how that works for you. I said, You get more money because you were E5 when you were in OCS. I was an E2 at the time. E5 is a buck sergeant. And I said, oh, okay. So I went to Fort Belvoir, Virginia for engineering OCS. And there I was forced into a situation where very rigorous training, great opportunities, met a lot of good people. But I came to the realization pretty quickly that it's not in my DNA to be a real leader of human beings. I've got a lot of skills. One of them being the boss isn't a good one. I've got a son who is, but I'm not. So again, I was forced. This is all internally interesting. I never really talked about anybody else in this. I wasn't used to doing that. So I figured, well, I should hang out here for a while. Because you get rated every once in a while. I forget how long the program was. But after a certain period of time, you're doing okay. If not, you go back and start again or blah, blah, blah. So I made it all the way to kind of the end. And then they said, well, we don't think you're really doing this well. You know, you need some more leadership skills. Why don't you go back and halfway and start again? And I said, not really. And so I said, we parted ways, and I ended up into a replacement company at Fort Belvoir. And very quickly, I got my orders for Vietnam.
So at Fort Belvoir, can you compare kind of the social community you found there compared to, I guess, what you experienced in high school?
Kind of the same way. Again, I have a lot of acquaintances, not a lot of friends. And that's kind of the way it's kind of who I am in a lot of ways. Really good friends with my wife. And I love my kids. I'm good friends with my grandkids, interestingly enough. But I guess maybe I just don't know how, or it's not in me to make. So I'm in a situation where all of these, a lot of, kind of a subset of the draftee military, or the draftee OCS people, but a lot of the people were there had been drafted. They weren't, this was pick them out of, skim the top 2%, if you will, of the basic, of the your AIT crowd, give them some tests and see what happens. And then throw them into OCS because we need new officers. There aren't enough people coming out of West Point because we got a huge army all of a sudden. And I know it's not really the best way to create a talented officer corps. You know, some of them are good, some of them are not. We just need them anyway, and that's the military way. Is that if you need 10,000 new second lieutenants, you got to get 10,000 second lieutenants. So again, it was pretty much the same way I was. That was probably one of my failings there, is that I didn't really, I looked at it more as an academic exercise, and I don't think that's what they were really looking for.
For sure.
I think they were more looking for, who is this guy? When is he going to make a good leader of men? Are people going to follow this guy? Are they going to shoot him in his, they're going to frag him in his tent at night because he's driving them all crazy? And so I think it was the right call in my cadre's perspective. Even though I aced everything that they did academically there. Physically, intellectually, I could do I was given tasks, I performed them well, but they figured out really fast that the military wasn't a good fit for me in a lot of ways, especially as an officer. As an individual contributor, I was fine. So again, it was probably it's who I am as a person. I don't think of it as a flaw. It's just who I am. I'm not a good, I don't know. We all have our strengths and our weaknesses. I embrace both.
All right, so you finish up your training at Fort Belvoir.
This would have been in went in September. It would have been, say, around July of 67.
July of 67.
Yeah, because I was in the, I got drafted in 66. I went in 1966. Oh, yeah. So then I was in the summer of 67. All my training is done. And then, it was probably more like August. And then at the end of, then when I went to this repo outfit, it didn't take me very long to get a, get orders to go to show up in at some detachment in Cameron Bay, South Vietnam.
All right. So, what do you remember the date exactly when you were shipped to Vietnam?
My date in, well, I showed up the day before Thanksgiving in 1967, and I came home the day I showed up the day after Thanksgiving in 1967. I came back the day before Thanksgiving in 1968. So I was not in country for Thanksgiving Day. I missed. Well, my last day at home was Thanksgiving dinner, and my first day back was Thanksgiving dinner. So how that works out, November 1967, the day after Thanksgiving, and then the day before. That was my tour of duty, those dates.
Well, I'm sure your parents enjoyed you having, having you home for Thanksgiving.
My parents were very, again, neither of my parents were very demonstrative in that respect.
Mm.
I mean, I think to my father, this is what you're supposed to do. You know, if we're at war, you're the right age, you've got nothing, you're not doing anything else. I had no excuse. So there really wasn't much. Actually, interestingly enough, talking to my sisters, my sisters, they, because I've asked them this question recently, and they told me they were worried every day. And my parents, I don't think, ever worried. So there's an interesting dichotomy within the same family. They sent me all kinds of goodies, and my sisters baked fudge and sent it to me, and my writing letters and stuff. So they were my sisters, who were, they were probably in middle school at the time. They're 6 and 8 years younger than I am. So middle school, maybe early high school age, when I was in country.
And I recall you said you have an older brother?
I had an older brother. He passed away at age 55.
Did he serve as well?
No.
Okay.
He actually worked for the NSA during the Vietnam
War. Oh, very interesting. Okay. So you're heading to Vietnam. Where do you first get in?
It's the airfield near Saigon. It's the main airport in the greater Saigon, sort of like JFK in New York City or Logan in Boston. Get the round trip name of it. But I showed up there very quickly, and then they shipped me immediately to Cameron Bay, which was I think it's an interesting little anecdote. So when I left my outfit in Fort Belvoir, I was friends with I had to show up at Fort Dix on November X, 1967. So I had my orders, and so I had a duffel bag full of clothing. And I was supposed to, so I had this period of time, say 3 weeks between the time I get my orders and the time I have to show up at Fort Dix. So it was 4 or 5 weeks before that I get my orders. And I think to myself, I'm not doing anything in this repo outfit. I'm just hanging around. So I go to the guy and said, hey, could you ship my duffel bag? Here's my orders. Put a copy, ship them to Vietnam. And I'll say sayonara. Just go home and hang out, and I promise I'll show up at Fort Dix on due date. So he said, sure. So bag disappears. I drive home in my civilian clothes. I have a Class A uniform to wear, my khakis. So I hang around them home, you know, doing this and that. See them doing, being a civilian a little bit. And then the time shows up. My dad drives down to Fort Dix, and he says, see you later, Bob. So I walk up to the, I'll get past the, I show my ID, go on base. So I walk up to the, in processing, and I say, here I am. And they go, who are you? I show them my orders, and they look around. I don't have any Robert Munson. What are you doing here? I said, these are my orders. I said, oh. What's your MOS? 12A10. Oh, engineer, combat engineer. Okay, well, we're going to send you to the X replacement battalion in outfit, whatever it was, in Saigon. Tansanui Airport, I think is what it was. So, where you go. So, I'm flying in commercial. If I get on a 707 with a bunch of other GIs, I go to Alaska, Japan, down to Vietnam. I show up, and I go to, again, I go to the in processing, and I say, I'm here. They go, and you are? I said, it's my orders. Rob Munson, God. We have no record of you. I said, so you probably don't have my duffel bag either, right? Not that we know, not that we're aware of. So I said, well, what am I going to do? He said, well, what's your MOS? I'm 12A10. Okay, 35th Engineer Group. They're in Cameron Bay. Okay, we'll send you there. So off I go. And then that was my... So again, I show up at the 35th Engineer Group. And you are, again. Here I am. Okay, well, we need a spot. We got a spot. Can you do anything different? Can you do anything special? Can you type? I said, yeah, sure, I can type. Well, they need a company clerk at the Charlie Company. So we'll send you there. And that was my... So I believe to this day that I could have just stayed home and they never would have found me. That was how crazy things were during that time. And I don't know. I have no idea where that duffel bag ever went. Probably it's in some depot someplace or maybe whatever. But it just had my military stuff in it anyway, which they reissue you when you came in country. You got jungle fatigues, jungle boots and all that stuff. So I got a whole new issue of clothing anyway. But it was kind of, and nobody really thought anything of it. Hey, this is, stuff happens and this is where you go. So that was how I got into, showed up as this. And so it could have been anybody else. I could have been, I give them that, of course, say I had an ID card, and my military ID, but I'm sure I could have said I lost that. I could have sent my brother and they would have taken him as well.
So you say you went to Charlie Company?
Yeah, it was Charlie Company. It was a line company. It was stationed up at the Central Highlands.
Central Highlands. And that was after Cameron Bay.
Yes. Cameron Bay was only there for a short period of time. Just trying to figure out we got this guy, this random human being. He's got these skills. He graduated from this. He's this old. Where's a good fit for him? Okay, we'll send him out here. Because our headquarters was in Cameron Bay. And all the line companies were out embedded with in some kind of an infantry presence somewhere else, supporting them, as combat engineers tend to do. And this was the one that had the spot that seemed to fit my skill set.
Do you have any memories of the day you moved to line company or joined line company?
Jumped into a Huey and flew up there.
Just flew up there?
It was always some... the mode of transportation in Vietnam was helicopter. Mm. The roads weren't very good. Places were... And they were not that safe. And if you had a small amount of stuff or mail, and it was always something going. You could always hook a ride going somewhere. There were choppers flying all over the place all the time. So that was the preferred mode of transportation. Oh, okay, you're going to go up on Tuesday because we're sending the mail up on that day. And this is when the choppers, so get your gear. You're going up that day. And there had been some communication with the folks up there to say, hey, he's coming. This is who you're getting. And he could be your company clerk. Because the company clerk could just rotate it out of there. He could type, so that's mostly fit him in. So away I went.
So this is around December.
December of 1967.
December 1967. Awesome. Can you describe what a normal day would be like for you? While you were with Charlie, I assume every day is a little bit different.
Yeah, because I was company clerk, I didn't have a lot of. I mean, I did have to pull duty, guard duty. Mm-hmm. I never did KP as far as I can remember, but I was kind of a floater in some ways because I had certain things, type up daily reports and this and that. But I was always easily. My job was not driving driving a road grader or, one of the heavy equipment operator, those kinds of things. So I was, when there was a kind of a person needed an extra hand to go places or drive this, they would yank me and I would fill in. So I had a chance to do a lot of different kinds of things. I loved going out of the compound into the countryside because it was really, it was very, You know, that sort of thing. Put me behind the wheel of a car and I'll go anywhere. I love driving. I'm nosy. I like to see things. So I tended to be on hand to a lot of different kinds of things. So as far as a normal day, well, I obviously had the morning report I had to type up. And other than that, I would, just kind of float around, look for something to keep me busy. And because I could actually touch type around 30 words a minute, I could typically get rid of my actual duties very quickly. And there really wasn't much to do. So I'd hook up a ride with the water point people that are going out to, you know, do some water purification system out there, or one of the wine companies. The guy's going to go out and work on some roads or fix a bridge. And I just kind of tag along. Said, hey, you guys need anybody? Yeah, sure, come on along. And that's where I first started driving Jeeps as well. It became my job a lot, was that because you don't have to have any special license. And again, there was Jeep drivers was one of the commodities that was very lacking, because a Jeep driver is supposed to be a radio operator.
Mm.
And radio operators are worth their weight in gold, especially at that time, because that was your money. So I don't think combat engineering department and company, because they're not out of the field so much, they tend to not get them. They don't get an actual 05 Bravo 20. And so I started doing that, started learning the Alpha Bravo Charlie Delta Echo, that. And I had a chance to do a lot of traveling around. And that was what I did. It was kind of a mundane job, doing a little bit of typing, a little bit of, working with anybody, working with the medics if they needed, keeping track of material, writing up requests for supplies, just that sort of thing.
All right. So we have on January 30th,
yep,
Tet Offensive happens.
Yes.
Where are you and what's happening at the base?
Okay. Well, that's the story. So I'm up in the Highlands. And so it was early in the morning, because I was sitting in the headquarters tent, typing up a report, surprise, surprise. And all of a sudden, we were supporting a MACV, Military Assistance Command Vietnam, Special Forces group, which was embedded with Army of the Republic of Vietnam, ARVN, company.
Okay.
And they were kind of attached. We were one big compound. They were on one side, we were on the other. So they had artillery there. So every once in a while they'd be shooting away. So we're used to the sound of these things. So I'm sitting in the tent, all of a sudden boom, boom, boom happens. What the hell's going on? Well, my first reaction is, it's normal. And then it's a boom, boom again. And then the tent sounds like it's raining. And all of a sudden I feel this in my side. It was shrapnel hitting the tent. And then I get a big piece of shrapnel on the side, not very big. And my immediate reaction was, it was really hot. I remember that. And I said, shit. And I had no clue what had happened to me, other than I had been hit by something. I had no idea how big it was, what kind of an injury this was going to be. And I sat down very quickly. Then I lay back on my bunk. I said, what? And of course, I have no idea the time for how long this took. And then very quickly, I did the fingers and toes, and then I rolled off onto the ground, grabbed my flak jacket and my steel pot and my rifle, and lifted up the side of the tent. I go, what the hell's looking around? What the hell's going on there? I see people running around. So I said, oh, shit. So I ran up to the perimeter. And what had happened was that there was a North Vietnamese group of guys. I have no idea how many. I think it was battalion strength is what they could guess. And they were about 2 miles away in a valley. And on the valley, next to the valley, was a elevated, a small hill where their artillery support was, which were mortars. And the mortars started, there was supposed to be this coordinated attack, and the mortars started shooting too fast, too quickly. They weren't coordinated, fortunately. And so our 105s were doing counter battery fire, which is why I heard these booms and nothing happened, while the incoming rounds were still coming in. So there was a brief artillery exchange, which our artillery radar control 105s versus a few mortars in the hills, the mortars are doomed. And then, so stuff's going on. So in that headquarters tent was our radio operation. And I heard all of this. I'd gone back to the perimeter, and they said, "Well, you know, we're just get more stuff." And I walked into the tent. So all of a sudden, I hear this stuff on the radio going on. Our radio operator was in there. What's going on? Blah blah blah. And so they called in air support from Dalat, which was the closest airfield. And so this is how long this took. I have no clue. It was just my brain was running. And then, so then at that point in time, we all go back out to the perimeter and waiting for something to happen. It's pretty quiet. All of a sudden, there's no more boom, boom. And then a flight of Phantoms, F-4 Phantoms out of Dalat comes in and napalms, bombs, rockets, you name it, where this poor bastards, this North Vietnamese group was there, and they got annihilated. So we're sitting there watching what's going on. So it's like, watching a fireworks display, if you will. And they never got anywhere near us. So there was no, and so then we went back in and we started getting word about what was going on. So we just thought this was unique to us, maybe. And all of a sudden we're listening on the radio and Dalat was one of the places that was one of the major focuses of the Tet offensive. So we listened as all hell broke loose in Dalat. And so we're sitting out in the middle of nowhere, kind of, and listening to all this stuff going on. And the final, we know there's a lot of stuff going on in the country, but all we have are just, chatter from pilots or whatever. We're just listening on the right frequency. Our AM outfit guys tune the right frequencies and listening to orders being passed, bomb this, do that. A lot of, like, listening to a war movie on radio. Mm. And nothing impacted us at all. And then our headquarters company in Cameron Bay, which was the safest place in Vietnam to be. They were never attacked anywhere. They had tons of, their security was run by South Koreans, and they are okay. And nobody ever went after them. So they put together a platoon of grunts, if you will, out of the headquarters company and flew them up, and they did a combat landing. It was an airstrip right next to where we were. So they came in. This is all, we're all sitting on the sandbags, smoking cigarettes, kind of, what the hell's going on here? And all of a sudden, a C-130 comes in, does a combat landing. Guys are jumping off the back, and then it does a quick 180 and flies off. And we're all just kind of looking over there. Oh, this is kind of cool. What are these guys doing? And they get out and they're all looking around like they think, you think this is the middle of a war zone. And we're all just, so they came to us and we said, calm down, guys. So we had to feed an extra platoon for a couple of days and then they flew them back. But it was just this kind of crazy goings on. So it really wasn't, again, we had been singled out as an easy target. But they screwed it up big time, and they ended up saying, "We're not the people they had tasked to do to get our outfit." Maybe because it was a MACV and an Arvin compound, that was what they were after. And I don't know, but I have no idea what they were doing. They might have been doing something in the around with the locals that they thought was, they were getting hearts and minds in the wrong place from their perspective. So I don't know, but they did come after us, but they didn't get anywhere near us. And then, so that was Tet. And then I saw the results of it when I went up north later, but because we left the convoy back to Cameron Bay. So the Tet offensive, I read about it in the newspaper more than anything else. And of course, it was all, we didn't have access to much information. All we had was the Stars and Stripes and hearsay.
Yeah.
So it wasn't much, we didn't really have much of a access to any strategic information, if you will.
So was there no sense of Tet being this kind of big change or big turning point in the war? It just
didn't change what we're doing there a bit. have no impact at all.
At all.
No.
So after Tet, of course, you were injured, as you said. What was the outcome of that?
I got a Purple Heart. I didn't, you know, I always thought, this is, even though growing, you think of growing up in a military family, you would know better. But I always thought of the Purple Heart as something as a, you know, if you're going to be awarded this medal, it requires some major physical injury of some kind. Mm-hmm. And all I got was a piece of shrapnel in the side. And so a couple of weeks after Tet, I'm in company Clarksville. I get this letter from, well, some communication from headquarters that the battalion commander's coming up and the following people should form up for a formation tomorrow. And I saw my name on the list and went, I wonder what this is all about. So we get up and he comes up and he walks down the line and pins Purple Hearts on us. And I was flabbergasted. I said, holy crap, I got this? Because we always be a fair number of, not a lot, but there were half a dozen of my company mates were injured relatively badly. And so I would never have thought that. And that's when I learned what a Purple Heart is and what it is not. So it's a funny medal in that respect, because what it really says to me more than anything else, and it writes it in indelible ink, that you were someplace where you were getting shot at and getting shot, you know, shooting up. Actual live combat action was going on and you were there and you got injured. So that's really what it means. There's no, you know, there's no indication of how badly it was or not. So it's an award that I think of as just kind of a check mark in some respects. It's not, you know, so you go, okay, well, then it leads us into a different direction. It kind of puts you into a, yeah, I've been there, done that kind of scenario when you talk to other veterans, if you will. That's a mark of, kind of like the next level will be the CIB, the Combat Information, CIB, the Combat, CIB is a badge you get if you've been in combat for a certain length of time. Combat Infantryman's badge. Mm. That's another thing that says you were there a lot and you were in some really bad places. And there's no requirement that you get shot or anything to the guy. That's what the true grunts who are in combat, that's a medal that you don't get unless you've been a lot of bad places and more than once. So that's, to me, that's the next step up from the Purple Heart. Yeah, I was there. CIB, you were there a longer period of time. Mm-hmm. A lot of bad things happening. So people who wear that they get a lot of respect from veterans for that reason.
All right. So after Tet, where are you heading next?
Okay. Well, I'm not sure we time frame exactly, but we hung around for a while. And then if you know the weather patterns in Vietnam, monsoon season happens at different times. Mm-hmm. In the north and the south. Well, being as how my outfit is, we're building roads and bridges and all that kind of stuff. When the monsoon is going on, it limits our activities tremendously. So monsoon leave is going away in the north. Monsoon is hitting in the south. We're in the south, sort of. So convoy gets together. They bring up some protection. We had some recordless rifles on jeeps. A couple of, you know, we had maybe a platoon of infantry comes up to guide us back. So we convoyed back to Cameron Bay. This was, you know, we've got to bring all our junk back so you can't chop our individual people. You've got to get in your... So we drove back from wherever we were back to Cameron Bay. And I use this, it was interesting. This was the only time I was ever actually what I would consider to be driving through the Vietnamese countryside in a safe and sane manner. You know, there were a couple of bridges that had gotten blown up to try to slow us down, but we never got attacked at any kind of level. And there's a whole bunch of us, company size is maybe 130 people. We had maybe another 25 or 30, so maybe 150 of us driving back. And it was a three-day trip. So we drove through a lot of small towns. And I look back at that, and I remember when we showed up at these towns, you know, a bunch of guys, we'd jump out of our vehicles and, you know, run around. Go and try to, you know, just kind of walk around, see what's going on here. And everyone, there would be some stores of some kind. We'd look around, could we get a Coke or that kind of thing. And most of us had funny money. It was military payment certificates. The U.S. currency was not acceptable for the GIs to have. So we would find some way to barter cigarettes, or maybe they'd take the NPCs or whatever. So we'd wander around this town. I look back on that, and I think that was one of those come later kind of attitudes. I'm thinking to myself, what would it have been like if I'm in some little town, Enfield, New Hampshire? All of a sudden, 150 Russian soldiers drive up, and they're armed to the teeth. And they just go walking and start walking around town, walking into the grocery stores, looking for something to eat, or chatting up with the locals. Think how weird that must have been to these locals, even though, you know, so these are small towns on the road now. So I wonder, the people were pretty friendly to us. They put on the face anyway. So look back, and I had some great views of scenery. I had taken some pictures, so I have no idea where they are. The mountain was beautiful countryside. And at night, a couple of nights, we hunker down, you know, like the wagon trains, and go in a circle, and, you know. So I look back at that. It was a chance to really kind of get a feel for the country a little bit. Little towns in the middle of nowhere, rice paddies, villages, you know. I never felt any kind of fear or anything. We just got a bunch of guys driving through. At the time, I didn't think of it I didn't think of it that way. But again, this is one of the reasons why my tour was, I think, a little less intimidating for me emotionally and intellectually, because I never really felt at risk. And I was too interested in what was going on around me, I guess.
Maybe. For sure. Do you have any specific interactions with the Vietnamese that you recall?
Yeah, I remember walking into someone saying, hey, they've got Cokes over there. So I walk into this little store. Of course, I'm wearing my flak jacket. I've got hand grenades on my chest. Carrying my M14. There is a round in the chamber with a safety on. It's cocked and locked, as you say. And I'm just, you know, I'm carrying it loose. It's not slung over my shoulder, because that's what you did. And I remember going in there, and I think my memory is that I was able to swap some cigarettes, a pack of cigarettes, for a couple of Cokes or something. And I remember feeling like I was just kind of going into a corner store in New York City. The thought process to say, because this is where I lived. I lived with my, you know, leave your rifle here, your life goes wherever you go. And I didn't feel like they should be intimidated from me. I didn't feel like us, me, and you. It's like, hey, I've got this, you've got that, how about we do this? And I do have a memory of this younger gentleman and just two people meeting up. Neither of us had understand a word the other one was saying, but, you know, you had kind of like when I go to Europe, you know, sometimes it's got to be, dollars, you know, marks, euros, what do you want? You always find a way. There's an easy way to find. You can find a way. My interaction, the villagers seemed pretty. It was, you know, it wasn't high. The women and children. It wasn't, just a bunch of guys coming through. Maybe we didn't appear threatening. I don't know what it was, but the Christmas was early in our interaction with the local populace over there in some respects. And they had foreigners in their country for a long time. So perhaps they didn't view us that way either. Not as much engineers coming down. They're fine. They're looking for something to drink. So my memory was, it was just a normal everyday kind of interaction. I remember, you know, substantial buildings. Wasn't mud huts or any of that kind of nonsense. Mm-hmm. So it felt like an actual village, town.
Very interesting. So you're driving through, you go through these villages and you arrive back at Cameron Bay. Okay. Are you staying at Cameron Bay after that, or do you move around to any other?
Well, they knew we were headed north.
Headed north.
They were reconstituting the battalion.
Yes.
To be shipped north. So all the line companies were coming back We had four line companies. They were all heading back for Cameron Bay to get together to refit to head north. And that was where I started deciding that maybe I had more value to the battalion than company clerk and Charlie Company. So the legal clerk was leaving. I'm X6 Hammacher. I have some names I actually can remember. And so they said, hey, Hammacher's leaving. It's going to be, we figured it's going to be at least a week or two between actual guys. So why don't you take his job? You work with him and see if you can figure this out, what's going on. And the legal clerk is someone who's, you know, you process, interestingly enough, any Article 15s, which, you know, spank on the wrist, the court marshals, I forget what else was going on. There was certain, just, it was a higher level of paperwork, essentially. But Spec 6 Hammacher was the, he was the guy who got stuff for the battalion. If you needed something unique, he was the guy that would get it for you. There's always some scrounger in the military. There was these guys. I learned all how it firsthand how some of the stuff you see in movies, it's actually true. So hanging out with Spec 6 Hammacher, he's running around like crazy. They decided they needed a couple of quick stories. We decided our battalion commander or whatever, whoever it was, the upper level, decided we needed, where we're going to go, we need our own mortars, 60-millimeter mortars, small. Even though we're not supposed to have them as an incumbent, that's not our job. So they go to Hammacher and they say, hey, Hammacher, we'd like to get a hold of a couple of mortars. What do you think he can do? So he goes, okay. He says, so he goes to the motor pool and he gets his Jeep. He had his own personal Jeep, which was not on, if you looked at our table of what we're supposed to have, table of equipment or the TOE, then we're supposed to have X number of Jeeps. Well, we had one more because he had scrounged it somewhere. So he traded his Jeep for two 60-millimeter mortars. So I remember this story. As I went down with him to get the Jeep, and he went into the motor pool and said, okay, I'm taking my Jeep out of here. And then, motor pool sergeant, what are you talking about, your Jeep? He said, yeah, that belongs to me. Guy said, that's not your Jeep, that's our Jeep. He said, show me the paperwork that says it's your Jeep. So 10 minutes later, we're driving out with his Jeep. And so that's one. And the second one was we knew we were going to be in country north during part of it. We were going to be there long enough to where the rains were going to start. Well, the only rain gear we had were these ponchos, which, they look good on paper, but they don't really. The stuff wicks through them and all that sort of stuff. Hammacher decided that he was going to get us some raincoats. So we went. Went down to some CBs, so CB group, because they know the Navy, because they're always getting wet. They have good rain gear. So he managed to finagle 20 raincoats out of them, and I happened to get one. He got one for me and one for a bunch of other guys. That story ends up later when I go home. Whatever. So I found. I'm watching this guy work, and I'm thinking, I can't. He's gone. I'm not going to be able to pull this shit off. So we go up north, and I'm still kind of by the time we go up north, maybe March 1st, early March.
Okay.
We land and we go to a place called Wonder Beach, which was a built-out landing debarkation for ships coming from the United States. It built out a port. Made a port. And so we should land there. We travel up the coastline in ships and we disembark there and we land there. And so at this point in time, I'm kind of the legal clerk. So I don't think this is a good place for me to be, pretty much. So I talk to the. So I'm now in with all of the battalion commander, the XO, the COM officer, the headquarters. Mucky mucks. So I said, geez, guys, this isn't. They said, oh, okay, we got a new guy coming in. Yeah, okay. So I said, well, so I'm thinking, well, what am I going to do? I said, I've been trying this radio operator stuff. I think, can I go, can give that a shot? I said, yeah, well, we're always looking for 05 Bravo 20s. So I thought to myself, okay, self, this point in time I'm a spec 4. I thought to myself, shit, I want to do this, but I want the right MOS too to prove that I'm doing it. So the legal clerk has access to demotions and promotions. And that's really, that's one way to change your MOS, is to get promoted into an MOS, but you have to get promoted into it. So I had to get demoted. Be an 05 Bravo 20 as spec 4, I had to get demoted to PFC and then promoted. So I became an 05 Bravo 20. And then I became part of the combo section. And that again gave me opportunity to do some traveling and all that other kind of stuff. And I became part of just the FM radio net, pulling shifts, 6 hours on, 12 off. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 8 hours on, 8 hours off, when one of those would go an hour and hour. And I also became the combo officer's Jeep driver, which gave me access to driving around the country. So,
did you travel anywhere specifically interesting that you think, did you travel anywhere that had any special significance to you?
Yeah, well, where we were at, we were pretty much due east of Quang Tri, which is almost up to the DMZ. We were pretty close to the north of Vietnamese border. And the closest, we embarked through Da Nang, and then we convoyed up north. So Da Nang was our port of entry and exit. That's where it took our NARS out of. Well, between Da Nang and Winter Beach was Wei, Highway 1. And that was where a lot of the real action had happened during Tet. And there's a lot of books and movies about, and they kind of focus in and around what happened there. And so I did convoy past, and driving up and down Route 1 to get, you know, convoyed down to Da Nang to get sodas and beers, and driving around to get our information. We had to get our codes and that sort of thing. So I had a lot of chance to interact with and see a lot of the detritus of what Tet had happened up there. And it was obviously, had been real combat in a lot of ways, a lot of destroyed facilities, bridges, homes. And driving by Wei, you could see the outcome, a lot of, you know, blown. And obviously this, the result of a real pitched battle with major artillery and the like.
Did you have the opportunity to talk with any of the soldiers at Hue?
Yeah, a little bit. Had some interaction with some of the Marines who were, there was, every time we went over a bridge, there would be a pillbox at each side. And we'd get extra beer and soda, and we'd sell to these guys on the way by. And they were pretty ethical. We didn't charge them significantly more than what it cost us. But yeah, we'd have a little comment. They would talk about some of the stuff that went on there and how bad it had been. And because most of them had been in combat during Tet. This was only a couple of months afterwards. So you hadn't retained a lot of them back. So yeah, there was not a lot of banter, but we, you know, just chit-chat kind of stuff. And as soldiers will do, it's difficult to talk with soldiers about stuff, I think. One of the things I've found out, and this is not necessarily limited to that, is that there are certain activities, like I've said this before, is that if you need a point of contact to be able to really talk with somebody at a certain level about certain types of things, and because you have to lay yourself bare in certain types of situation, and that to be able to get into the details. And I think certain types of things, it's really hard for people to do that. Well, it's like what we're doing now. And that I trust that you're not going to think poorly of me. But this, that was it. But we Vietnam vets, that was a really tough battle to fight, because I'm kind of tangent, I'm segueing out here, is that public's perception of this people who were there had no relationship with my experience. You know, all the Apocalypse Now and Full Metal Jacket and this and that. And most of the people who presented themselves at the time as veterans did so in a way that made me not want to be part of that group.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of tough. So interactions with, so I'm not sure, I segued away from where I was starting from, I think. But a lot of the dialogue we had with the in-country people, I mean, we're all there, sucks, you know, nobody wants to be there. We're all just trying to keep our sanity as much as we can. So any opportunity to chat up somebody, especially someone at your relative rank,
mm-hmm,
if you will.
For sure.
You kind of grab at. And of course, sometimes it's, you know, you start going and you say, oops, you know, you want to kind of push away because the person you're talking with is getting off into some really weird stuff. Either they're stoned or they're, you know, they've lost it. Had a few of those too. So it's always, again, I think that's one of the reasons why I was able to be so, I would never had these problems because I knew how to withdraw.
Yeah.
Emotionally, intellectually, without maybe showing it.
Mm-hmm.
So it never impacted me. My reaction would be, ooh, what's going on with this crazy dude? And then I would back down, just continue the conversation. I'd try to slide it into something a little differently. So I did have a few interactions with mostly Marines. A lot of Marines around the DMZ. So I had a fair number. And Marines were the ones who were in the thick of it most of the time. That's what they are. They're the tip of the spear. That's what they've always been. Their job is not what I had as a job. So I'll stop there.
We're in around March or April,
yeah,
right now. Okay.
Early spring.
And you're going around the country. You've been to Hue. And you've kind of been bouncing around. At this point, have you received a whole lot of communication from home? I know you talked about having some letters with your sisters.
Yeah, it would be my family keeps pretty much everything. I would write probably once a week, and I would get back probably the same pattern. My sisters always sent a box or something. They were great. I could make the best fudge on the planet. I was well liked from that. When a box showed up for me, they knew what was going on. But I didn't get any. It was always pretty pretty vanilla. You know, I look back on some of the letters. I reread some of my letters, and I have to admit at the time I was like saying, "What are we doing here?" You know, because I'm out there and I, you know, fixing the same road every day. We're running, you know, it never seemed to be, we weren't moving the ball down the field.
Mm-hmm.
We're playing football and we never get past there on the 50-yard line. It's like, after a while, it's like, this is the best we can do, it's time to go home.
Yeah, for sure.
Right? We're just playing defense here all the time. We're just trying not to get pushed back to the 40. We're not trying to get to the other team's 40. And that became pretty obvious after a while when my interactions with, now I'm really out of the country. I'm talking with all of our line companies on a regular basis. I'm sitting in headquarters. I'm, you know, driving down, up and down Route 1 all the time. So I'm out in this, and this is one of the more active theaters in the war. Delta was a little bit was more active. But it's like, nothing's going on. And, you know, shit would happen once in a while. You know, one of one of our mine would get killed, or once in a blue moon, some sappers would try to breach our compound. Well, we had an armored cav outfit that ran our perimeter, and to control the perimeter. And they had, back in the days, these great big night vision apparatus mounted on their main gun. Mm-hmm. And they would, these tanks, they weren't M1s, but the main battle tank of the military at the time, they would run around. And the sappers never, I mean, it was every once in a while, in the middle of the night, we would just, you know, explosions, holy shit, what's going on? And we'd all jump and run out to the perimeter. What the hell just happened? And in the morning, one of our bucket loaders would go out there and scoop up the remains and dig them in a hole and throw them. So, you know, it was, which is probably not normal, but it became pretty normal because they never got anywhere near us. And you'd think after a while they would give up, but somehow unless they figured, we got to keep on trying this every once in a while. But we were so well guarded, there was no chance of us. And we weren't doing the guarding as much as the Army Cav people were doing it. So, looking at what was going on there, it was just every day is the same thing. You know, it got really, you know, what's going on? And our companies, again, our line companies were all embedded out there on these landing zones and just doing the normal stuff. And we had, one of our companies got overrun one night. And, but that was, you know, I was over there, I'm here. It was, I forget the right word, but, so stuff was happening, but it was it would happen and then nothing would change. Mm. Okay, well, you know, they got attacked, you know, I had to call some medevacs and we helped them out and this and that, and then, okay. Tomorrow's a new, okay, got to rebuild this, we got to send some more, they need some more people because they lost 10 people, so we got to send replacements out there and figure this sort of stuff out. But nothing changed. You know, and after a while, especially if you're someplace where you're supposed to be making a difference, and we got these tens of thousands of armed to the teeth soldiers and equipment, we're spending a fortune over there, and you'd think that something would move down the, you know, get better at something, you know, have not as many attacks and this and that. So it became, and the tone of my letters at the time would reflected that. It's like, what are we doing here? Because I saw a lot of people, a lot of young guys getting addicted to drugs, behaving badly, thinking myself, and nothing happening to them. It was kind of, we know this is going to happen, so because we got draftees and whatever. And my officer corps seemed distant. They weren't involved. They had didn't have any respect for most of them. So it became obvious that this was not a commitment that our country was making seriously. You might say that it's serious, but it wasn't, because nobody could keep on that, doing that for. And the other veterans I've spoken with, they all have the same idea that some of them are very bitter about it, some of them are very cynical about it. I just think the people that were in charge didn't have a clue what they were doing, and they had to pretend that they did know what was going on, because if you're the boss, you can't say I have no idea what I'm doing. Well, you can, but you got to be good about it. So a good boss will. But, and that was the problem with that, is that it just wasn't, no coherent strategy. I mean, granted, I was just a Spec 4 radio operator, but I did have access to a lot of communications. I did travel around. I saw a lot of what was going on. And, I was the point of contact for a lot of stuff there, too. Sad to say. Marijuana was cheaper than tobacco. Mm-hmm. The locals grew it in abundance, I guess, whatever reason, Vietnam was a good climate for it. And the locals would roll up a whole bag full of joints and sell it. And I was still a tobacco and beer guy at the time. I dabbled in a little bit of those controlled substances, but I guess maybe my personality is that I don't need to get high. I want to be able to see what's going on. I don't need to get away. So I was the point of contact because I'm the guy out there. I said, hey, you know, could you stop by? And so, yes, I saw a lot of that. I didn't get involved in that on the personal level, but so I saw and I would see what, you know, the lethargy that would set in with the stoners would get. And so I saw the net result of that, thinking, do I want that? And the answer would be, I don't think so. So it just got, and this is, you know, this is wink, wink, nod, nod stuff going on too. Just wasn't, you know, if you get in your career, you're going to work for some companies and it's going to be the same damn thing. You're going to work for a company that knows what they're doing and they go for it and they make it progress. And you're working for some places, you think to yourself, this place is not going to last. They don't know what they're doing. They have no business model that makes any sense. And that was our military in Vietnam. I don't think it was necessarily, I'm not cynical about it. I don't think it did it on purpose. I think it just was the people in charge. We didn't have enough Pattons and Bradleys and Eisenhowers. Mm-hmm. We had the military had become maybe too politicized at the time. I don't know. But the strategic objectives were never actually going to work. It just wasn't going to work. And tactically, we never lost a battle.
Yeah.
The tactics were great. You know, those of them, we're here, we're going to get them. And we always got them. But, okay, now what do we do? We'll look for some more guys and we'll get them. Okay. And we're going to wear them down eventually. I don't know, these people have been fighting wars for a long time and nobody's worn them down yet. So why do you think what we're doing now is going to be more successful than what you do now? So, whatever.
Do you think the other soldiers matched your level of frustration? Do you think they were as aware of the lack of progress?
May sound a little tooting of my own horn, but I was 21 on April 4th, 1968. I had a really very strong educational background. I had a strong family background. And I had seen and done a lot of things prior to going over there. So I think I had a little different perspective on things. I didn't expect it too much. I guess there weren't a lot of gung-ho guys, but there were some. Most of them were just putting in their time. And I didn't see a lot of... Because I was there early. Don't forget, I was there when the war was young. And I think pretty much everybody was willing to accept the fact that, they'll change tactics and stuff. Didn't have a lot of people that were really anti-war, anti-military in my outfit. Plus, it was... The combat engineers were a subset of the whole were not the same as the infantry.
Mm.
I'm sure had I been in an infantry outfit, seeing all my troopers getting killed on a regular basis, mostly in sniper attacks, booby traps, you know, that kind of thing, no real combat, I might have had a different perspective on it, but I didn't see a lot of that. We did have, I think I looked it up, on the time that I was in country, I believe there were about 100 casualties in my battalion.
Mm.
Out of us, force of maybe 600 people. No, more than that. And this people were taking out. Not only that many. Four line companies, five. Maybe more like 650, 700 people. And there were 100 casualties. So it was a fair number of people got killed. Mostly the line companies during things happening. But and some suicides, car accidents, that kind of thing. So I didn't... I think it's our human beings, if we're wired correctly, we can adapt. And I adapted pretty quickly, pretty well. Came after a while, it's, a road grader guy gets killed. Not grading the road, cleaning the road up. It's a mine, it's gone. Guy played cards with the night before. Sort of like I never really got that tight with anybody. So it's like, this is an accident at 89, somebody gets killed. It's like, of course your first reaction is, thank God it wasn't me. Second reaction is that, that's too bad. And then, but car accidents happen, every year a bunch of people get killed on the roads in New Hampshire and you move on. And there weren't enough casualties in my outfit to rise to the level of worrying about that perspective of it. But, I think I was probably a lot less impacted than most, but it's hard to generalize, I guess. But it depended on where you were and how. So few of the people that actually served in the military during that era actually saw combat, really. So I'm skeptical about a lot of what I hear and see. Because the people that I've met through my various groups that have been in combat in whatever war they were in, most of the ones that I've met were World War II, Korea, or War on Terror, up until we bailed out of Afghanistan, had a certain amount of pride of their service. Mm-hmm. Vietnam veterans are angry and cynical, and I am neither. So I guess that puts me into a different category than most. But then again, the veterans I've met are typically combat veterans. So again, it's a subset of a subset kind of thing. And it's a real hard question because my experiences don't seem to mirror a lot of other people's, but I was there. I could do that stuff. So I don't know.
So coming back to the U.S., so you wrapped up your last few months in Vietnam. Was there anything specifically?
I got my 2 R&Rs to Hong Kong.
How were those?
Oh man, that was a lot. That was great. Two great times. Yeah, it was fabulous. Hong Kong had been the R&R port for the Fifth Fleet, our Pacific Fleet, mm-hmm. since kind of forever, and the Brits too. So they knew how to give a GI a good time. I don't need to go into too much more detail there. And I hooked up with somebody the first time I went on the plane going over, who had a friend who had been there before. So he had a contact with a pimp/tailor, which are the two things you do when you get there. You buy clothing and you buy women. And so I was able to kind of get into the... And we ended up with two other guys who were better of a foursome. And the other two guys were just great. We had so many laughs. And we just went off. Four of us and the four ladies who accompanied us, we just went all over the place, had a blast.
How long were you in Hong Kong for?
R&R, 7 days.
7 days.
And I went back again, typical ones in finagle, I pulled my... typical and that was on my finagle. Own. But it was an opportunity to kind of feel human again.
Were both R&Rs in the later months?
Or? Yeah, I took my first one in August, my second one in October.
Oh, wow, okay.
So I waited along, because I lost all my records, I had no money. They couldn't pay me because they didn't know who the hell I was. So it took about 6 months before the military had figured out, Bob Munson, RA11920225. So all of the records that they could find got transferred out to my existing outfit, at which point in time they owed me a lot of back pay, they owed me this stuff. So it took me, I couldn't have gotten an R&R anyway. So then I was there six, then I waited a little bit longer, and then I took my first one. And luckily I went to Hong Kong. But, and then the monsoon hit very quickly, and they moved us out of Wonder Beach, maybe in September, October time frame, mm-hmm. and to LZ Nancy. And we just kind of hung, by then in the monsoon, nothing really much was on, so we just kind of hung around. Although we did, I think we did skip over the one thing that, the one aspect, when I was in Wonder Beach, we did go up in our outfit. I was just back in the camp. They went up and we were part of the relief column that brought the Marines out of Khe Sanh.
Oh, really?
Because they were, they had been there for a couple of 3 months and supposedly guarding the Ho Chi Minh Trail in the DMZ, the upper left-hand corner of Vietnam. And they'd been under constant artillery barrage for months. And these guys were, and they came into our, they distributed, and they came back, they distributed some into each of the various outfits. And so I ran into some of these folks, and they were completely bonkers. Fistfights would break out, and chow lines, these guys would just yell, scream, ah! And so we were all, what the hell's going on here? But, so that was my first, I guess you could say that's why I understand what PTSD is. I've seen a lot of good examples of people that just lose their mind. They don't no way to cope with the slightest issues. Mm-hmm. It's to fight. So that was, and I think that was in late summer of 68. And so then I hung around LZ Nancy for a while, and then time comes up for Bob to go home. And actually coming back from, let me give you another quick anecdote. Coming back from my second R&R, which was not a legitimate R&R, but I took it anyway. So I had my own words typed up. In good with the legal clerk. And so I'm coming back and flying to Da Nang, and I have to get back to my outfit in Wonder Beach. So we landed in Da Nang, and then they said, choppers are how you get around. So I had to. So I went to the flight line. Said, hey, I got to get back to, you know, Wonder Beach. Guy said, okay, well, we got a Marine recon squad that's going up there. It's going to pull test the wire activity tonight. So you want to go with them? Said, okay, I'm going to say no. So there was a sergeant coming back from R&R too. So two is, he said, go that chopper over there. They're leaving at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. Go with them, and they'll get you through the wire and you get back. You know.
What was the? You said test of wire.
They were testing the integrity of the perimeter.
Okay.
They were going to do an attempt. They were going to pretend to attack. See if the guards were awake. So sort of, and of course everyone knew about this, so nobody's going to. It wasn't a live fire exercise. Okay. The people that were coming out had live fire, and we're just going to see how close they could get before they were. Noticed if they were. So the sergeant and I, we got our suitcases and we're jump on this plane with a squad of face blacked, gunned up Marines. And they fly us up, drop us off, and then the guys are infiltrating through the underbrush, and the sergeant and I are walking along behind him in our class A's with suitcases. Hey, this is pretty cool, watch what's going on. So they finally, the exercise was done and walked through the wire. So, which of course at the time I thought nothing, this is nothing odd. This is just, hey, I needed a ride and these guys give me a ride. So the war is over for me. Go back to fly out of Da Nang home. And it just so happened that it's the day before Thanksgiving. And I fly into commercial. Straight flight from Da Nang to Seattle. Arrived, there's a song by Arlo Guthrie called When a Soldier Makes It Home. And one of the lines is that he flew them in at midnight and unloaded all the sacks. Well, that was me. They flew us in at midnight into Seattle Tacoma Airport, which is right next to Port Louis, Washington. And then we walked up, there's a plane load of GIs coming home. And this is November 1968. And so they take us into, they have to go through customs and, we make sure we didn't bring anything in contraband back. And then we go to our, take us in and say, okay, guys, and they gave us a voucher, which would give us airfare, you could trade it for airfare back to where the closest airport to where you were inducted, which to me was Logan Airport in Boston. Mm-hmm. So they said, okay, guys, we can hang around and we'll feed you a nice steak dinner, breakfast, whatever you want, or you can just leave. So everybody said, I'm out of here. We get on bus, they drive us to the airport. And immediately all of us run into the men's room and change into our civilian clothes, which I suppose you could say is a little different than when the soldiers came back from World War II, or perhaps Afghanistan. Well, actually, in Afghanistan, I think they brought him into military bases and they hung on to him for a little while. They didn't let him just immediately go back into the population, but we did. But so he's a, this was happening probably every night anyway. So every morning in Seattle at the SeaTac airport, there's a couple hundred GIs that are going home. And it was pretty obvious, although we didn't have buzz cuts at the time. But this is November, and we're all tanned like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah.
So it's pretty obvious who we are. So I put my civvies on that I bought in Hong Kong and get a flight back to Boston. So I get on the plane. This is, again, a culture shock. Here I've been, spent 12 months in a third world country, and all of a sudden I'm dumped off in Seattle, Washington at the airport. And so I get on the plane and had one stop in St. Louis, interestingly. So we get into St. Louis and I'm sitting on the plane. And this was spring break, not a spring break. Thanksgiving break. So a whole passel of young ladies come on the plane, some college in St. Louis, and they're going to Boston. So one of them is nice enough to sit next to me. So we're and being who I am, and she's kind of cute, so I started chatting her up, and very pretty much she knew where I had come from, and very pleasant. She said, "Oh, by the way, my parents are coming to the airport, pick me up," because I had mentioned the fact that I was actually got out of Vietnam 3 days early, so my parents did not know I was going to show up, and I had no way, I couldn't, no cell phone, no call, I just going to show up. I said, "Hey, you know, when you get there, how are you going to get home? I'll call my parents. Where are they? They live in Rhode Island. Oh, gee, my parents live there. We're going to come up. We'll drop you. We'll take you home." Okay. So get off the plane in Boston. And her parents show up. Nice. "Hey, back in Vietnam." "Yeah, hey." Very welcoming. I said, "Sure." You know, because I'm time I'm like, because again, this was early. I didn't expect to have a cadre of anti-war protesters running around at the time. It was still pretty early in the war. So get right home, and she drops me off at my parents' house. And I walk up to the door, knock on the door, and here I am. They had no idea. My parents, again, were pretty non-committal about it. My sister were very happy to see me.
I'm sure.
And the next day, I sat down to Thanksgiving dinner. So I'm back. Not out, but I'm back. Again, you know, it's a really bad way to reintegrate soldiers anyway. And we had never done it that way before. World War II, because they weren't flying people, they were shipping them back in boats. So it was months after you fired your last round before you were actually back in the population, if you were civilian population. And during that time, you had plenty of time to decompress. You know, they would, you're starting to wear clean clothes again, you're eating normal food, you know, the chaos is on, you're a city, you're with all your buddies. Obviously, when they got back, things were a lot calmer. And then we've done that, and then now I know they do the same. Now they do the same thing, only instead of the Afghan war on terror guys, they fly them back, but then they keep them in. You know, they have their family, but they keep them on post. They don't just say goodbye, because most of them are actually still in the military, and they're going to be in the military for a while afterwards anyway. So they're still part of their unit, and although there's still a lot of issues with people that have been downrange a lot, but they are subject to a lot of problems, and just emotionally, it's really tough for. And I don't know how they got. And both, actually, the World War II and the Afghan War of Terror people have a lot in common, because World War II, you sign for duration. And Vietnam War was a year, and you're done. And in Afghanistan and Iraq, and they keep on sending them back over and over again. So they're, they know that, and it's a volunteer. In both situations, the vast majority of the people doing this raise their hand and say, "I'll go." So the dynamic worked. I think they used to work, and then they didn't. They totally blew it with my group, and then they got a little better, but it's still not very good. You know, they have a lot of things in place, but still, it's you have to self. You have to raise your hand for it. They don't make it. They don't do a very good job of getting people who have seen and done that stuff. Haven't found a way to. Encourage them in a way that they're going to accept to seek counseling and to get them back. So,
did you have any difficulty readjusting? I know you said you weren't really affected by much in the war, but was there anything that was difficult?
Just another day in the military.
Just another day.
Never. I don't know if I'm that unique. Just the way I'm wired, I guess.
So, we're at Thanksgiving. What's the next move?
I'm home for a leave. I'll leave maybe 3 weeks, and then I go down to back to Fort Belvoir, of all places. So I was still thought of as being an engineer, even though I'm a radio operator at this point in time. And I've got not the 9 months to pull until I'm out. Not getting out until September '69. So I go down to Fort Belvoir, and it's for Belvoir being engineering OCS and a few other things, it's one of the few places, it's actually the closest actually active duty military outfits in the DC area.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of support, as an engineering outfit, they've got a lot of road graders and heavy equipment. So they help with snow removal in DC,
okay,
and that kind of stuff. It's nice to have an outfit around like that. So I was attached to a combat engineering battalion in Fort Belvoir, 18th Engineering Battalion, I think. And I'm a radio operator. So I'm an 05 Bravo 20 with a Purple Heart Vietnam veteran who's got 9 months to go. So the battalion commander says, "Ooh, I want this guy driving my Jeep." So sounds like a good job to me. So I became the battalion commander's Jeep driver.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a good gig. Because, again, they would go out and maneuver as a battalion, and colonel would say, "Hey, Bob, if I got to be out of this, I'm going to be living in a tent out here for a few days." He said, "If you want to go back to the barracks, as long as the Jeep is here, 7 o'clock in the morning, I don't care what you do." So I dropped him off, and the first sergeant's behind me. He wasn't too pleased with that. He ended up with he was a great guy. This guy, great colonel. He knew I was getting out. I did a great job. I helped, I was the guy that would, some lieutenant would say, "Oh, my radio wasn't working." And he would drive over there, and, some ground wire would come loose or something.
Do you remember his name for the, recording?
The colonel's name, I don't know, commanding officer, I don't remember
his name. Oh, no issues, no worries.
But, he appreciated who I was.
Mm-hmm.
He said he had somebody, and he treated me with respect. I treated him with respect. We, for a full colonel in a spec 4, I know that the sergeant major in the back seat wasn't too pleased with the camaraderie ended up. I didn't call him Joe or whatever his first name was, but he did call me Bob. And because he liked, I did a good job for him. His Jeep was always clean, ready to go, gassed up. Anytime we had to have problems with somebody else's Jeep, he had a guy, "Hey, well, Bob will take care of that," and I'd fix it for him. So he loved it. I was a good, so we got to be pretty good. I wouldn't say friends necessarily, but we both, I respected him, he respected me, and got along really well. And then in the summer, one of our line companies went to West Point every summer because the plebes, their freshman year, don't go home.
Mm-hmm.
They spend the summer after the freshman year, they stay at West Point, and then regular Army outfits come up and introduce them to the various branches of the service. "Hey, this is what these guys do." So every summer, one of our line companies would go to West Point, spend the summer teaching them about combat engineers. So West Point isn't that far away from East Greenwich, Rhode Island. I said, I went to my boss, the colonel, and said, "Hey, would it be okay if I became the Jeep driver for the company commander of Charlie Company who's going up to West Point?" He said, "Yeah, sure, I'll talk to him." So I had to be his Jeep driver. So we convoyed up. Real funny, interesting military convoy from Washington, D.C. to upstate to West Point, trying to drive around the tunnels, and somebody would get lost, and we had to go try to find somebody. Oh, my God, and I was a Jeep driver. Oh, God, Bob, where the hell did he go? I don't know. We're trying, like the sheepdog and the sheep. So we get up there, and I spent the summer teaching them land navigation. Every day I'd go out and have another 20 cadets and show them how to use a compass and this and that. And then we'd send them out into the woods. There were 3 of us, I think, that did it. And then it was supposed to be a 4-hour exercise, and getting late. Okay, we jump in the Jeep. We know exactly where they screwed up. This is where they'd end up. We'd go and pick up the 2 or 3 and they got lost. It's kind of an interesting. It was an interesting interaction because I'm the same age as these guys, pretty much. Well, I'm 21, but actually this time, So it'd been 19, so I'd been 22 at the time. So I'm a 22-year-old Vietnam veteran radio operator. And they're a 18, 19-year-old, soon to be first lieutenant.
Yeah.
Second lieutenant. So it was an interesting kind of dialogue because I'm supposed to be telling them and they're supposed to know it all. And, so we had this kind of interesting back and forth. And then on the weekends, I bought a car when I came back from Vietnam. On the weekends, I would drive back to Rhode Island. And I ended up becoming friends with my brother's secretary. My little brother was working at Digital Equipment Corporation at the time. his secretary took a shiny to me. I think she was trying to get, she liked my brother, but he was married, so whatever. So I would drive back and forth to, on the weekends, I'd drive down the Merritt Parkway back to, and come back and, you know, arrive at Reveille at 7 o'clock in the morning on Monday. I'd make, you know, driving all night Saturday, Sunday night to get back in time. So for the last couple of months of my tour, I was, you know, up in West Point fiddling around. And then I drove, then went back to Fort Belvoir at the end of the summer. And September 29th, whenever I got done. I'm out of there.
Where do you go from Fort Belvoir? September 30th, next day.
I went back to Rhode Island where my parents lived. I got a job at in Massachusetts, working as a warehouse manager for a company who my sister-in-law, married to my older brother, was the PR, was the personnel manager for a leasing company. So she got me this job, which is where I met my wife, who was a secretary at one of the big wigs in the leasing company, and the rest is history. And I met up with her. Started going out in June, got married in October. 6 months later, I let her know that it was time to go back, me to go back to school. I needed more education. I found a two-year college in Atlanta to go to, it was called Southern Technical Institute at the time. Right now it's Kennesaw State College now. Went down there, spent a couple, 3 years, GI Bill, wife's working as secretary for VP of a bank. Actually, the president of the bank, actually. My wife was a tremendous personal secretary. She went to Katie Gibbs, and she was great. Hard worker, great skills, bright. And spent 3 years on the GI Bill, settling my life. And then we decided that when we're going to move back, I'm going to graduate. I was trying to decide. I had an option for a four-year degree, but you know, I got my two-year. And then it's like, well, she's like, my wife, I've got to go back. I've had enough of Georgia. You know, I love it here, but... And then in October, I guess, of my senior year, earlier than that, we find out that she's pregnant. Mm-hmm. So I've got to go back home. So I got a job at GenRad, General Radio Company in Concord, Massachusetts. And the rest is history. And then started up on a 40-year career in technology. Ended up starting off as an entry-level technician, ended up as a senior software engineer. Ended up running a data center later on in Boston. A very successful wife, went back to school nights, ended up being a principal financial analyst at Raytheon. So we both had very successful, she stayed at home for a while. She was 30 years at Raytheon, I was 40 years trying to get a job at a company that would stay around. A company that kept on working for companies who went out of business. Digital Equipment Corporation, Wang Laboratories. A couple of smaller companies then, big human service company in Boston where I ran their data center for their voice and data network for 13 years, a couple thousand employees. It was a good gig. That was probably the only job I ever had in my life where I was a perfect fit. I had started out being a boss for all the technicians, and I knew that's not what I do.
Yeah.
So I convinced my management as it got bigger and bigger. I said, I need to spend all of my time in the data center and in the PBX, a personal branch exchange, we had our own phone system. I need to keep on top of what's going on with the stuff, latest revisions of software, this and that. I don't have time to be the boss of these people. So they said, okay. So they hired, I knew exactly who I wanted, this young woman who was, she's always kind of wanted to get into the racket. I said, Nicole is who you, and this is the person you have to hire, and you got to give her a nice raise to do this. Okay. So I segued into the technology guy. I didn't have to work with our clients. I never had to work with the clients. I didn't have to work with our employees either. I had a team that was those people. And so I spent the last 7-8 years of my career just making sure that nobody ever lost any files. Sure, data, everything was always up to date, worked, and kept them reasonable and even within the budget requirements of a nonprofit, I was able to keep us on top of the technology. You know, didn't really know, I knew what we needed. I'd spent a lot of time going to seminars, conferences to see what HP's doing next, and do we really need that? And I had enough knowledge to be able to make decisions about whether or not So when the bosses would come and say, hey, I heard about X, I said, yeah, you know, I know about that, but I don't think it's a good fit for us, and this is why. And they would go, okay. Or, yes, you're right. That's perfect. Yeah, you did a good boy. That's exactly what we need. I've known it for 6 months, it's exactly what we need. So I learned how to, you know, it was a good fit, really good fit for me. Because I had a lot of responsibilities, which I'm more than happy to have. I want to be responsible. I want the, I'm willing to take the hit for a failure, but I want, I'd like to have the kudos when I had success. And I think that served me well. Because I think after a while, your boss is going to think, I trust this guy. Say, I need that. We need to do this. And I was a cost center, not a profit center. So they didn't ever, never really wanted to spend any money, but they never really wanted to lose any data. And I was the senior technology guy in the company. So they had to trust me. Or that's my line to them is, if you don't trust me, you better fire me now. Because I can destroy this company and I can go there and do this and all your files are gone forever. And I can make it look like it was a, was an act of God. If you don't trust me, baby, it's time to get rid of me. So I could never do that. I consider myself to be an ethical, honorable human being. I would never think of doing that, but you know. So that was my career. Three kids, four grandkids, successful, married 52 years. That's who I am, I guess.
How did you make your way up to the Upper Valley?
My parents bought a place in Eastman in, with my older brother, actually, back in the early 80s. And I was a, my brother lived in New Hampshire at the time, in Amherst. And a big skier. And when Eastman was being built up, he found it, and the prices were great. So he convinced my parents to go in halvesies with him on a plot of land, which turned into a condo. And then he was, so a couple of years later, he gets trained, he's going to Denver for his job. He's, tax transfer not there. So he convinced my parents to buy him out. And so it was my parents' place. We're living in Rhode Island at the time. We're not skiers, like we have this place in New Hampshire. So my wife and I are the only two close by. My other siblings have moved out in North Carolina, whatever. So it was my family. It was our weekend getaway, winters, summers. So the wife and I and my three kids were all elementary school at the time. So it was a great getaway up here. So we got to know the area really well. Kids all learned to ski, play tennis, all that stuff at Eastman. And then my dad passed away. My mother moves down to Maryland to live with my sister. Sell the place. Eastman's gone. And the kids, you know, my kids are off to, you know, high school, done, college. They're off. Wife and I are just, you know, both professionals, making good dough, traveling around, doing our thing. And then we both get old and time to retire. So I knew I had to get out of Massachusetts. I never really was comfortable there. Mm-hmm. And it's where all my wife's people are. So she, you know, she wasn't quite as enthusiastic about it. But so we got to find a place to go. I just wanted out. I always liked the Southwest. I'm thinking, well, we should get our RV and drive around the country for a couple of years and check everything out. My wife is internally thinking, Torture, they're going to kill me. Oh. So, and we got grandkids. Now we have grandkids at the same time. And it's like, oh my God, we're going to do this. So we finally said, oh, gee, I think it was her idea at the actually beginning. Oh, let's look at Eastman. So 2007, I think, 2000, no, a little later than that. Maybe 2012, 13. We started looking. I retired in 2013, she retired in 2014, so maybe 2015 or 14, whatever. And we're living in Lowell, a nice condo on the river, nice place. And so we come up here, started looking around, and the prices were unbelievable. They were properties that were being given away, right? Because Eastman never recovered from the 2008 housing recession. I don't know how it was like in Lebanon, but it was, you know, this was a cheap place to live. So we started looking at that. Holy, whoa. So I said, I can write a check and buy that place. Okay, so we bought a condo here and rented it for a couple of years and then finally sold out of Lowell because we were still involved with my daughter had twins and we were still involved with them a lot. So We had two places for a while, but that got old really quickly. And then we it took us a while to sell our place in Lowell. And 8 years after we bought it, we sold it for exactly what we paid for it. And then we moved up here full time, and then redid the condo. You know, got rehabs of all of the place, and I've been living here ever since, and it's been great. Grandkids come up all the time. They've learned to ski. They've involved in summer activities. They're now 14, and my oldest son's kids are both in college, so you don't see them as much. But my son, oldest son, just came. He got out of the military, and he was working his way up through the ladder of success of the corporations, and he ended up 2.5 years ago in Mansfield, Massachusetts. So all three of my kids now live in Massachusetts. My grandkids are now, my older ones are off in college, one's in Montana, one's in New York. And so we love it up here. And so we already kind of knew what it was like. You know, it's close enough, but it's far enough away. It's a great area for retired people and people with kids in school. Little kids. Young adults, maybe not as much, but it's perfect for us.
Have you had a lot of interactions with veterans since you've moved up to the Upper Valley?
Yeah, well, I'm in a book group with Roberta Stewart, who's a professor here. And when I got out, there's a place called the Vet Centers, which is a subgroup of the VA, and it's for combat veterans. Mm-hmm. And they have a lot of services, counseling services. They do a lot of great things with vets. And I ran into the one I got out of the military. I got prostate cancer very quickly. And I had no history of that, so I ended up using them. I have a small disability because of that. But I also got access to counseling there, which had this great psychologist. She was fabulous. I had her for a couple of years talking out. Learned that I have issues that I wasn't aware of. And so the vets, through that, I found that there's great people there, that people that helped you out with all kinds of things. And so I was with them for a couple of years in Lowell. They had great vet centers. There are vet centers all over the place. And so I got to meet a lot of guys there, mostly Vietnam veterans, but a fair number of War on Terror vets. And that's actually where I met Roberta. She came down, she was on a sabbatical or something. She was doing something at Harvard, I think, maybe. So she talked, to be honest, at that vet center. So mm-hmm. I met her, and that's how I started with that. And then, so I got back into the veteran community through that. I get meeting a lot of these, I say, War on Terror. There's a soldier from New Hampshire who has the Medal of Honor. Hmm. And I met him. And I met two Medal of Honor winners, actually. And so I had this great, had a lot of great experience. And then I came up here, and there's a vet center at White River Junction. And I connected with them, but their sweet spot wasn't me. Mm-hmm. So we kind of passed ways. But through Roberta, I've met maybe 20 other vets in the Upper Valley. And because they're dark, because this area tends to have, as its demographics, a lot of pretty high, well-educated, strong people. I mean, Dartmouth, I think it's because they had some kind of a link with Dartmouth, either they went to Dartmouth or they, you know, they worked here or whatever. So I had a good group of guys that I've been, and gals, that we've been doing our book readings with over the years. So the last 2 years have been really tough because I'm not a Zoom guy. I just don't like Zoom. I hate it. So now we're trying to push Robert into the online, but she's had some... Don't tell her I said that. She knows.
Yeah.
Most of us really don't. It just doesn't feel the same. And because we had it for, I've been doing this maybe 8 or 9 years, and I had the first 6 of that once, one day a week, 6 months of the year, get together, have a cup of coffee, talk about a book. Zoom doesn't cut it. So we know what it could be. And what it is now is really a small percentage of what it used to be.
Have you noticed any, I guess, similarities between the Vietnam War veterans and the veterans on the War of Terror, the younger ones?
Over the last 6 to 9 months, the answer is absolutely yes. Before that, no. When we ran away from Afghanistan, the way we did, again, I think soldiers who got it. One of the things I think the military does to you, it puts you into a situation where you have to really examine who you are from a, you know, words like honor, ethics, mean something a lot more to the typical, to a someone who joined it, and to, for a military person. It, you know, because you get put into situations, first of all, anybody who has more rank than you can tell you to do anything and you got to do it. So, mm-hmm. No, I don't want to do that. Do it. So in a situation like that, you really start to understand what it's like to have your management, if you will, people who take that seriously. They're not going to tell you to do something that isn't right because you have to do it. If they charge that hill and they know you're all going to die, well, wait a minute. We have to do that. You knew we were all going to die and you did it anyway. So you have to, there's a certain basic understanding that we're all in this together and we all have to pull together. So in my war, because I think that was broken, that we, because, and it's more about the way we ran away at the end in 1975 when we said we're going to help you guys out forever, but we don't think we want to do this anymore. Mm-hmm. And the Congress cut off the funding for the Vietnamese. That was the wrong thing to do. And but whereas the Afghan guys, gals, they also were put in the situation where they saw a lot of friends die, maimed, and they thought they were doing something. They thought, they trusted that they were being told to do this for a good reason. You know, they trusted that people are not going to say send it back again and again and again. If they don't, if the people who are doing that don't recognize that these people are doing this, they're putting their lives on the line. Mm-hmm. You better have a damn good reason for doing that. And up until we ran away, I mean, we were done. I mean, we had a couple thousand troops there. Hadn't had a combat casualty in 18 months. So it's like things had kind of settled down. We kind of won, if you will, in a way. Like we, North Korea is still, you know, South Korea is still an entity, right? Berlin Wall came down, you know. We know how to do that. Instead, we just said, nah, we don't want to be here anymore. We're going to run away. And oh, by the way, we know we're going to leave a lot of Americans there and some soldiers are going to get killed on the way out. But nah, what the hell? We're going to leave. From the day that happened, we're on the same team now. Mm-hmm. I've noticed that there were two vets in my group who had a real close relationship with their interpreters in country. They knew their families, they knew these guys who were putting their lives on the line too. And they felt that, you know, again, they were the people who were supposed to be ethical. So they're telling these guys, you work with us and we'll take care of it. And then they leave and they expect the people who come in behind them to be the same way. People at times said, nah, what the hell with them? They broke those vets. The Iraq, Afghanistan vets were broken by the way we ran away. We left them. So they're on our, it's interesting that all of a sudden these guys are like, I know how you feel. I know how it feels to say, you sent young people into combat. A lot of them were screwed up and emotionally, physically, died. And you just, we don't want to do that anymore. We can't afford that anymore. Well, what do you mean you can't afford that anymore? So it's just money? Is that the way you're running away? How about all this money you're wasting over here? Couldn't you shift that over there and keep this going? Nah, we said we're going to. So that has come full circle. Up until when we ran away, I think the basic attitude of them was, yeah, things were kind of screwed up. But in the end of the day, we settled things down over there. It's a front line of our war on terror. You know, we're embedded in Afghanistan, which is where a lot of the stuff is going on. We're sending out, you know, we're working with the locals. We have access to, you know, Pakistan and lots of other places. So it made sense. It kind of made sense. They could see what we had done had actually accomplished something. Mm-hmm. And now it's all gone. So, yeah, it's, I guess is the takeaway there is that I lend it to the fact that we have, in this country, we've decided that people in charge, this is a relatively new phenomenon, that the people in charge, the fact that none of them have ever been in the military, they've never had anybody in their family serve, that's okay. and the people that are around them, none of them serve number decay. And these are the people that are making the decisions to send people in harm's way. And none of them, none of their immediate family is ever going to be, is, has a chance of ever having, of being involved in that. So it tends to lead one to be very skeptical of their motivations. And so again, I don't want to get political here too much, but if we're going to be in a situation where we're fighting, we're sending a lot of people into harm's way, I think the people in charge have to recognize that they have to go a little further than one would expect to keep, to recognize that the people, they need to help those people understand why they're doing that and have a damn good reason for putting them there. Not some vague, you know, nation building or something that we know is never going to happen. It never has, so why would we think we're going to do it now? The Romans weren't able to do it. The Greeks weren't able to do it. You know, the Germans didn't do it. The Japanese, you know, the Britons. I mean, hell, they had half the world at one point in time. They don't have it anymore. So why are we going to do this? I don't know. Where's history teaching you that this is going to work? That you people of this type, you can impose your morality, your ethics, your behavior on these other people who have their backstory is so different than yours. You look at how you got to where you are. Look where they are in that cycle. And you expect that you're going to get them there without, they have to get themselves there, bottom line. You can try to help them get there, but you can't get them there. And hubris, I guess, is a good word to throw there. I don't think the people that are doing that are doing it because they, which is, this is my point for military. I don't think they're doing it for, because they're bad people or they're, I think they believe what they're doing. I think the people in power in this country all think that they know the right answer. But I don't think they have the experience necessary to actually come to the right answer. And I look back on my military career and I'm very pleased that people say, thank you for your service. My response is, thank you, but it was my honor to serve. I learned a lot about me. I learned a lot about human beings. I was placed in a situation where I had to really understand, get to know who I am. And I think at the end of the day, I decided that the best way to be is to be as honorable and as ethical as I could possibly be. And that's the best road forward. I haven't always been successful, but I've tried. So that's me. Well, he said smiling.
Well, I think that might be a great place to finish off. Thank you so much for coming in.
Okay.